Today we're going down the history lesson of further conversations on the impact of not only the Atlantic slave trade, but the chain of events that led to it. And I'm going to share my theory and why I feel like Mansa Musa, for me, is not someone I will be celebrating in any form for being the richest black man in the history of time.
I'm curious to hear why. My people, welcome back to the Jolo Mr. Madi podcast. I'm your co-host, DJ Anzo, and I'm here with my main man, the GOAT, Young Money Millionaire, Uncle E.
Come on.
What's going on? Hope you guys are good out there. We're back with episode 5.
This is 6.
6.
Wow.
We're
globetrotting.
Bro.
Sheesh.
Moving, grooving, as always, but hope you guys are staying well. We're here in our undisclosed location, of course. And, you know, boys are back.
Come on.
What's been going on, bro? Everything good?
Everything's good. Following the news of Arab beefs. And that's been everything I see in NBA playoffs.
Yeah.
So that's been going on.
We'll get into that
before
discussion
that, though,
later.
You know, we have to, on behalf of the Jola Mr. Madi, wish you a happy birthday, Anzo.
My brother, appreciate you.
Wishing you many happy returns, blessings and wellness.
Amen.
So here's to another year. I don't have anything to cheers, but blessings, fam.
I appreciate it, bro. Yes. You know, we're always, you know, one more year means one more year wiser, so yeah, we're grateful. We thank God and we give thanks always.
I mean.
But yeah, so today we're turning into the History Channel because
BBC History Channel. BBC, which one are we? Al Jazeera? I like Al Jazeera.
I actually like Al Jazeera.
Al Jazeera is like,
You know another good one is the Faces of Africa.
Faces of Africa.
Which one is that?
Like, that's on YouTube.
No, but and there's a channel that actually does it.
I can't specifically.
It might even
remember.
Be a Chinese channel.
Faces of Africa is legit.
Yeah. So Faces of Africa, Al Jazeera.
Mm-hmm.
Who? What's my brother from the UK?
Which one?
I forget his name. But yeah, he runs with BBC.
BBC is legit too. Yeah. It's crazy, you know. I hate to give it to British Broadcasting Company that they make very good documentaries or report news, but. Yeah. I mean, that, remember on the radio, that BBC theme song, once you heard that?
Yeah.
Come on, if you know, you know.
You know, you know.
Sheesh, 5 o'clock news.
DSTV kids. That's crazy.
Wow.
But yeah, we're talking about, well, quite a bit of things, but
sheesh.
I'll let you kick it off on this history lesson.
Yes, Anzo.
Slash.
Gather around.
We're around.
Today, we're going down the history lesson of further conversations on the impact of not only the Atlantic slave trade, but the chain of events that led to it.
Mm.
So I always like to think, and for me personally, background is I'm now at a phase where I'm even trying to understand more my country, Gambia, the history, how it came into being, how the Atlantic slave trade had a huge role in identifying Gambia and the river and everything that came to it, right? It's always a multiplying effect. It's a chain of events. And I have been going through personal discoveries. And this past trip I went to Gambia, I went to what is known as James Island, formerly James Island, which was a fort right in the center, located right in the center of the river, an island, which was used to control the River Gambia.
It's called the River Gambia, yeah?
It's on the River Gambia. It's okay. An island right on the River Gambia, about 20 miles from the mouth of the river, from the Atlantic Ocean. Man, you find James Island. There's a lot of history on James Island, and it tells you, the history really dates you back to the 15th century.
And who is it named after? Because usually these
James Island, it went through many names of colonials, whichever, you know, whether it was the Dutch or the Portuguese or the British. And the British were the last person to have control of this island. Then it was called James Island.
Okay.
And there's a lot of history on it. And this is a place that as a kid I always heard of, knew of, but never really went to. So I got a chance for the first time to go to James Island, and the whole journey was just extremely just heartfelt for me. Like, it was just everything about it. But before we begin and I share my journey, when I was doing some research on slave ports, the discovery of West Africa, which was primarily through rivers that took you inland, right? I was like, nah, let me try and go back to, and I wonder even have you thought of who told the Europeans where to go? How did they know? What were they searching? They must have had some indicator that around this region of Africa, there was an abundance of not only black people, but riches such as gold. They must have known. They these things like wasn't, I know they were explorers and they were just searching new areas and territories. But what I'm about to share is there was a whole campaign of over 100 years to get to the western part of Africa.
Okay.
Right? So I'm like, someone told them there must have been a major event that led to news spreading all over, all the way to Europe, that has must have given indication that if you do come to this region of the world down south in Africa, there lies riches in both humans and whether it's gold or whatever it is.
Yeah, infinite resources almost.
Yes.
Yeah.
So here we are now. We start with a king called Mansa Musa.
The goat.
So before I even start, what are your opinions on of Mansa Musa?
Well, the stories I know of Mansa Musa are, so put in today's terms, he's the richest man to have ever lived. Was a king of the Malian Empire.
Yes.
And largely is responsible for spreading a lot of like riches to the empire. But then along his pilgrimage, when he went to the Mecca, built mosques, built, I think to build schools. I don't know about that.
Yeah, but he built a lot of Islamic schools around the region. Yes.
And then on his pilgrimage to the Mecca, and then even inflated the currency in Egypt because they didn't have that much gold. And on his way back, on his way there, and then those are the stories I was told of him.
How do you feel when you hear that the richest man in history was an African king and hearing a story of him and his trip to Mecca, which is probably the most notable?
Mm-hmm.
Generally, what's your feeling about it when you hear that? Is it a sense of pride? Mm-hmm. Is it a sense of empowerment in terms of what an African king was able to achieve? And generally,
yeah, I think if we're talking high level, yes. Of course, it's nuanced because how did you get that rich? What was the lifestyle like back then?
Yes.
Is that lifestyle compatible to today? Obviously not, but yeah, like generally, I'd say it's like a good
feeling. Yeah, I think so too.
Yeah.
When I first heard about it, I was very proud. I was like, oh my God, wow. Look at how powerful Malian Empire was.
Mm.
Look at what a king was able to do. And you go on Twitter, you know, TikTok, even social media, there have been a lot of creators who have brought light to the richest person in history was a black man. And we take that as in, yes, look at us. And I largely felt about that.
Mm.
But now here we are. When I learn more and think deeper, I really have questions.
Mm.
And Mansa Musa, being a king that is known as the richest man in the history of time from Africa, West Africa, the more I learn and research about how he became rich and to what he did in terms of the world knowing him, as of now, I have a strong feeling where like he's probably the most colonized African of all time.
Mm-hmm.
I look at him as a sense of no longer pride.
Mm.
And I'm going to share my theory and why I feel like Mansa Musa, for me, is not someone I will be celebrating in any form for being the richest black man in the history of time.
I'm curious to hear why.
Okay, here we go.
Okay.
So Mansa Musa lived from 1312 to approximately 1332, right?
So he's 20 years old when he died. Is that what that's saying?
13.
Oh, sorry, 13. Okay.
His reign. Yes.
Okay.
But he's most notably known for a pilgrimage to Mecca.
Yeah.
From around the region of Mali across the Sahara Desert, all the way through Egypt and down into the Middle East, right? In 1334, he embarked on this journey. And just to give you a sense of the scale of what this pilgrimage was, right,
mm-hmm.
in his trip to Mecca, it is said that when he was traveling to Mecca, he went with about 60,000. Let me make sure I even get this right, because this doesn't even sound right. He went with about 60,000 black men, African
mm-hmm.
men,
mm-hmm.
all wearing Persian silk, including 12,000 slaves, right?
Mm-hmm.
Who each carried 1.8 kilograms of gold bars, heralds dressed in silks, bearing gold staffs, organized horses, and handbags.
Mm-hmm.
Think of that scale, Anzu.
Mm-hmm.
80 camels, each carrying about 23 to 136 kilograms of gold. And this well documented.
Yeah.
His journey of going through things you said, going to Mecca for pilgrimage, passing to Egypt and causing inflation for about 12 years.
Mm-hmm.
Here's an African king with this much amount of wealth and gold, and to be able to make a trip across the Sahara Desert of this scale to the Middle East and into Mecca leads me to ask two questions. One, why?
Mm.
Why is a king who is blessed with so much riches in the land that he's reigning from, that many people to that scale, why is he going to Mecca to find or seek God?
Mm-hmm.
That's my first question.
Okay.
It's a pilgrimage, right? So mm-hmm. he's an Islam, he's a Muslim that has been blessed to be king. The land he's from, God has blessed him with all the riches. But I'm questioning why he decides to showcase all of these riches in going into the Middle East.
Mm-hmm.
To find God.
Mm-hmm. And then your second one?
So that's a colonized man.
Mm.
That's my point one. Colonized. Point two is the origins of some of the African mentality we see, right, is when we always, let's say, have riches or accumulate wealth.
Yeah.
Why do we feel the need to seek the validation of the colonizers in one way or another?
Yeah.
So I question, why is a king who has this much, feels like he needs to show that much of his wealth, not to neighboring African kingdoms, not down to sub-Saharan, why does he feel the need to take all of that to go to the Middle East?
Mm-hmm.
And I heard there were Spanish people involved through that region.
Mm.
Why? So those are two questions I really thought of. And the more I think about it, I was like, okay, so in 1300s, Mansa Musa went there. He did all of this. He flexed all over the place, basically, and sent notice to the world that we came from this region of the world, this is how much riches and gold we have at this scale.
Oh, I see. I see what you're saying. Okay.
He dropped a pin on us.
Ah, okay.
This is my theory.
Okay.
A king going with that scale in Europe and through the Middle East, you have indirectly showcased the amount of wealth and gold and people that are in this region you come from.
Mm-hmm. Okay, I get your theory here. Okay. And I'll build on that.
All right.
Yeah, keep going.
So what happens next, Anzo,
mm-hmm.
in terms of after this pilgrimage? 1300s, the word spreads out. The word spreads out that the king did this, inflation for 12 years, the African king, down in that West African region is the gold reservoirs where he amassed that much wealth to cross the Sahara with that skill. Let's give you 100 years later. The Europeans are finally coming out of their dark ages and they're starting to make advancements in technology. And the kings, such as Portugal, Belgium, around those areas, heard that there was gold down in this region of West Africa. And were paying explorers, funding expeditions to come and discover that gold. How will these kings know that there's that much gold and are willing to expend? How? I always say the major event that has happened must have been Mansa Musa's trip that has spread that to that region to know that there's that much amount of gold there. Okay. So in the 15th century, the race to find the gold began, and specifically Prince Henry of Portugal started really allocating resources to expedition, to explorers to find this gold.
Yeah.
And in that, the caravel was also discovered. The caravel was the ship that really was the major advancement in maritime expedition, where it could chart across rough seas. It was fast, it was maneuverable, it was agile, and could go long distances. So you now have the technology. You have the information that around this region of West Africa, there is so much gold, so much people, that these kings are sending all these explorers like, go and find that gold for me. So it begins. But you see how God or Africa, how we are just protected. For 100 years, Anzo, one from explorer to explorer, they could not get past what is now known as modern day Western Sahara area, Canary Islands.
All right.
They could not. And it was almost believed that there was a sea monster there that prevented them from being able to come down deep into West Africa. And the reason had to be in, you see, they could sail from Lisbon, as you see here.
Yeah.
And they can go down, they would go around the coast, right? All the way to Cape Bahador, all the way to now we're looking around Western Sahara.
Yeah.
But they couldn't go any further because of vicious winds around the coastline.
Right.
And even if they tried to return, they were unable. So many ships got lost. So there was a natural barrier with the intense currents around the coastline in that area, which prevented the explorers from being able to go further down into real West Africa to find where the gold was. And this was called like the Volta de Mar. They tried for years, for hundreds of years they tried, and they couldn't do it. Then comes a man who is called Gil Ins. In 1434, this Portuguese explorer, after trying many times, figured it out. And what he figured out was the maneuver to how to return. So he realized that you can sail all the way down into West Africa, but in returning and avoiding the winds along the coastline, you had to sail west as if you're heading towards the United States. And then there were already easterly winds that pushed you back.
Yeah.
So what you're seeing here is this loop that is called the Volta de Mar. It's a maneuver saying if you want, you could sail down with this ship all the way past through West Africa, but the returning part, which they couldn't do because of the vicious currents and winds, you can avoid that by just sailing east towards Cape Verde Islands, west towards Cape Verde, and then maneuver your way.
Can I just come around the top?
Yeah. Come around the top. Volta de Mar. What was Burkina Faso's original name? Upper Volta.
Upper Volta, yeah.
So you see how the history travels down?
Yeah.
But within that 100 years, basically Gil Ins is the first one to make it to Cape Bahador through this maneuver in 1434. And look at what happens right after, once he figured out. Cape Blanco Tristão, 1443, goes further deep. Then you go to Diaz, another explorer, discovers Senegal, the modern day region.
And they just keep expanding. Yeah.
Finds the Gambia River.
Yeah.
Gomez goes through Guinea-Bissau. You see how then the Portuguese, through this one explorer, Gil Inns, were able to figure out how to arrive to West Africa. So the whole thing why I'm saying this is Mansa Musa's trip 100 years earlier indirectly gave notice to what we're now becoming, what we call these colonizers, that there's an abundance of gold and black people in this southern region of the Sahara Desert in West Africa, where this king is from. And these kings spent 100 years of funding expeditions to go and discover that. And mind you, if I tell you from an Atlantic slave trade standpoint, Portugal is ended up having about, when I went to the NAMS medium, I think 5 million black people.
Oh, yeah. They're
the Portuguese.
Yeah.
So you see the Portuguese, how they discovered West Africa.
Yeah.
They're the first to do it. They found us. They were the first to find the rivers, starting from through Senegal, through River Gambia, to you start going down. They discovered that western part of Africa, right? Where the Mali Empire was. And they found the rivers that took them inland to find the people and the gold. And all I'm saying this is, looking back at history, my theory is it's because of Mansa Musa wanting to flex across the whole Sahara to go to the Middle East and showcase that much wealth and people that led to 100 years later, so the region being discovered.
You think that the pilgrimage, right, was sort of not... It's indirectly responsible for like this hunger of the Portuguese kings to.
It gave notice.
Right?
Yes,
it's almost like he came in blowing a trumpet.
Yes, and he then dropped the pin on us.
Yeah. Okay. I can't hate on the theory.
This is like, my theory, guys. Yeah. This is just my theory, Anzo. And again, I'm just thinking, why is the king? I know. So Islamic conquest happened very much earlier in West Africa, about 632 CE, around that region. Right after the Prophet Muhammad's death, Islamic conquest began through North Africa all the way down through western parts. They made it past the Sahara. So long before colonizers through European powers came, the region of West Africa has primarily, especially around Senegal, Mali area, has been Islam. Like Islam had already spread through. Kings had adopted it, established trades with the Arabs, and in addition, the religion was picked up, and, you know, trades happen in both human and also stuff as, you know, gold, Persian silk. How did the African king have Persian silk?
Those trade routes existed.
Trade routes began, and the religion spread.
Okay. So you, Uncle E, what you're saying is you think Mansa Musa was flexing. And he indirectly started the colonization.
The Atlantic slave trade, yes.
Yeah. Okay.
That's just my theory. And I also to note, he's not a king I will in any form celebrate. Because, again, I think, why is an African king going to the Middle East to find God when he has been blessed with so much in his land and his resources?
I think that one is probably a little bit more straightforward because he's.
That's why I say
he's going for the pilgrimage, right?
Right, he's going for the pilgrimage. So we have to understand why, and those are questions I'm asking in terms of how strong the Arab and Islamic conquest was, and how much it had a strong stranglehold on West Africa to that scale where a king is doing that much of a trip for pilgrimage to Mecca.
Yeah, that one's mad. Did you ever read the book Guns, Germs, and Steel?
No.
When you get a chance, you should check it out because that book talks about sort of why the world order is the way it is today and how guns, germs, and steel quite literally influenced that and how proximity to it allowed others to sort of develop technologically quicker. For example, the Chinese discovered gunpowder.
Gunpowder, right? Yes.
But you can't take gunpowder from China to Africa. So we're living in abundance, right? We have, yams everywhere.
Facts.
You know, cows, everything. Like, life is relatively good there. But the gunpowder makes its way into Europe. And then, you know, it talks about, like, the tech or industrial revolution and how that shaped a lot of the world. And sort of we were living in the most, I guess, natural way. And we didn't need these things. And so when they were introduced, it was a matter of, like, you know, the wrath of God almost, because how are we going to fight guns? Like, the Maxim gun is responsible for conquering Nigeria, you know? Same thing here, like, with indigenous and Native Americans, how the smallpox wiped out so much of their population and how that was weaponized. So it's an interesting book. Some people don't. Anyway, people always are opinionated on things, but I think, like, from a factual perspective, it brings to light a lot of the stuff that you're talking about. So I'd recommend that one for anyone.
I'll have to check it out.
It's a long read, but whoever or anyone who's interested in that kind of stuff, as you can see here, we're history buffs. So
yeah, we're trying to understand the chain of events. I always say it's a chain of events, right, that lead to things that happen. And again, they always theories, and you try to find connect the pieces, but this is just me sharing also how much I enjoy and what I'm learning about it. So
hey, I'm following the train of thought, bro.
That was part one with the Mansa Musa. All
right.
So then we come to the series that came out in 1970s called The Roots by an African American named Alex Haley, who also wrote the autobiography of Malcolm X. So Alex Haley was tracing his ancestry and found out the ship where his great-great-great-great-great-grandfather, not that far in line, because probably was three generations or two generations, great-grandfather, which ship landed in Maryland or sailed from. And he discovered the ship left from Gambia, James Island, and his great-great-grandfather was, the slave was known by, you know, Kunta Kinte, from the village of Jufre. So he pieced out, okay, he needs to go to Gambia and he needs to discover Kunta Kinte, James Island. And so he did his research and then he found the story and he released a series called The Roots, which was such one of the most influential pieces of in U.S., you know, history, from a film or just overall just impact on Black Americans knowing about the journey of their ancestry, right? Roots is, if you haven't watched The Roots, you should go watch the series.
For sure.
It was in the CNN docuseries where they talk about, like, the most influential films, movie series of each decade, and The Roots was definitely there.
I think probably the century.
Roots, yeah. So you have to see The Roots. And he found, you know, James Island, and this was always a place I wanted to know. I'm not going to go on Kunta Kinte, but you should go and look up Kunta Kinte, The Roots, and the whole story and how he was captured and kept in James Island before putting on a ship from the River Gambia all the way through the U.S. that so many of, not their ancestors, but my ancestors too, went on the ship, right? I always say the difference between me and an African-American or an Afro-Caribbean, or it's just that my great 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 grandparent didn't get on the ship, but they did. But it's our ancestors at the end of the day.
Yeah. Oh.
So that's why this whole divide thing never makes sense. It's our ancestors.
Yeah.
Long story short. So I'm probably about to do the first voiceover in a podcast from a video, but I want to keep it short. So I'm going to hit play. So Alex Haley, as noted, went to Gambia, documented, learned about his ancestry, learned about the story of Kunta Kinte, came back to the U.S. and produced The Roots, which, if you haven't seen it, again, you need to really go and see the series Roots, especially if you're African-American. So where is James Island? James Island is centered right about 20 miles upstream of the River Gambia, as you see here. And it's now 1/6 the size it used to be, but if you knew it, you controlled it. So here I was. I wanted to go see how the colonizers did it. It was a beautiful morning. And as you can see, I'm charting down the tributaries on a beautiful morning from Banjul, heading towards the River Gambia. So this was my view. I was on a speedboat early morning, just feeling like a colonizer. So for the first time also in my life, I was charting down the River Gambia. And this is how it is. Beautiful, beautiful place. Approach now James Island, which is now 1/6 the size it used to be. And of course, you're greeted with cannons pointing on both sides. So they're still there. Here's how the island looks. It's still the remnants of the fort. And get ready to get dizzy. Just showing how what's still left of it here. The fort, that's what used to be. So, and then you find one of these. And the picture already looks very scary. And you just look at it, you know darkness happening there. I was even still, this step even to walk down in here was even difficult for me to do. And these are what, it's crazy how through the erosion and destruction, the bad stuff, stuff that the terrible things that happen is still there. So such prominent. As this dungeon here where God knows how many black people were kept in here, squished in sandwiches before and having one air hole in there before being sent out. And this is what the island used to be. You know, you had the fort, slave houses, and Asnode cannons protecting it. So if you had control of the island, you controlled the river, inland and out. What went in, what went out. And this is me saying my goodbyes to Kunta Kinte Island and what it's left of it, what's left of it. And overall, it was just a great reminder of the darkness of the transatlantic slave trade, the darkness of slavery, the darkness of colonialism. And, you know, I charted back down. But one of the big takeaways I had from this trip was strictly from actually getting to on the River Gambia.
I'm not going to lie, bro. Even just watching it right now, I wasn't there, but watching it was...
Bro, I was like...
It was heavy.
It was heavy for me.
Yeah.
It was heavy for me. And the biggest things that hit me was, you see, as you get on the river, you know, the River Gambia, and it's where it's merging with the Atlantic Ocean, it's very rough.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it's rough with waves. Like, man, I was on the speedboat. Like, it is very, very rough. And as you start charting down the river, the water is just peaceful, bro. Mm. It's calm and peaceful. It's just a smooth, peaceful ride. And as you approach Kunta Kinte Island, the water started getting rough again, bro. It was as if I was getting, like, you felt the spirits of the bad things that happened. As you approach the island, the water is choppy, it's rough, it's violent. It's almost like a reminder of just terrible things and violence that happens.
Bro, that's deeply, like, deeply spiritual and profound.
So that's what I took of it. And, you know, it shocked me. I'm like, man, imagine our ancestors being on a boat.
Mm-hmm.
Even when you just get on Kunta Kinte Island, you put your own shackles here in the darkness. You don't know where you are, but you know the boat is moving and then it's calm because you're on the river. But as you're approaching the Atlantic Ocean, the water is rough.
Mm-hmm.
It's wavy, shaky. Think of how scary that could be.
And it's also symbolic.
It's almost a symbolic of you leaving your peace where you're from to going into bondage. It was rough. So, yeah.
Bro, I just got goosebumps from that, bro.
It was very heavy for me, and it's one where I always say, whether you're Gambian, whether you're African, whether you're African-American, Afro-Caribbean, while the island is still there, to remind yourself of our past and give you more empowerment of why we need to really be strong and progress and unite as people. This was another good reminder for me.
Bro, that was powerful. I'm not going to lie. Like, I know, and I think Ghana has done a good job of also, like, trying to portray,
you know,
the past and how deep that was. But this one is different, bro, because the metaphors you used here of, like, the smooth water on the River Gambia and then the choppiness of the Atlantic, or when you're approaching it, you can't make that stuff up, bro. Like, that's, hey, I don't know, you know, what other people believe in, but to me, that's deeply spiritual, and that's the ancestors saying something.
The ancestors spoke to me the whole trip, man. It's very spiritual, and like you said, Ghana is doing a good job, and I just wanted to take light to it because it's now called Kunta Kinte Island.
Yeah.
It's renamed, no longer James Island, but the island, if in a few years, will be swallowed by the river.
It's erosion.
You saw it. There was no one there. It's erosion. There's not a lot of maintenance. They're not doing anything to.
Who's in charge of it?
That's a great question. I don't know. So such a strong piece of history is about to be wiped away by the river. So I almost felt like, man, I better get a chance to go see it before it's gone.
And how long was the journey?
It took me an hour to get there on a small speedboat.
Mm.
In an hour back. It's only 15 miles inland from Banjul, the River Gambia. If you had a really strong speedboat, you can get there in 30 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
But again, just wanted to bring light to it that here's an island that has so much history that was occupied by the Europeans. If you had James Island, Kunta Kinte, they always fought for it. You mm-hmm. controlled what went inside.
Mm-hmm.
So you saw the cannons still there, pointing both ways, controlling our own land, our own people. So yeah, I just wanted to bring right to it that unfortunately the island will be gone if there are not major investments by the Gambian government to make sure we protect the island from erosion. If anything, try and reconstruct how it looked to be.
Yeah.
Like, this is such a piece of history that all black people who've been uprooted, all African Americans, Afro-Caribbeans, anyone should go and see and feel what I was telling you.
Mm-hmm.
But it might be gone.
Thank you for documenting it, because I mean, I felt it and I'm just seeing it.
So
I
just wanted
screen,
to share that. That's my, that's all I had for history. So I know I've rattled along, but yeah, like, it's just very, the whole point of just being Gambian, being from Gambia, the existence, how it's impacted me, how we became colonized, why did we get colonized, why did the Europeans come here, what were they searching for, how did they know where to get here? That's just me trying to understand that, just being history geeks. And right now, I'm pinpointing at Mansa Musa. I'm hoping for someone to prove me wrong.
Yo, that's crazy. Man, that might have been one of my favorite episodes that we've done. That was a...
So I'm ready for the Uganda history next time.
That one, I'll cook that one up.
Yeah.
Because that one's also quite interesting with the outside... the outside forces and colonizers coming in and how layered it is.
Yes.
But yeah. Now, man, might need to make this trip sooner to Gambia.
Look, Anzo, come on, let's go again.
That one was mad. But yeah, hey. Need to give Black Americans their reparations ASAP.
Facts.
ASAP. Anyway, we can get into that later, but we're going to sign out from here.
Yes.
It's been a big history lesson for myself and I'm sure our listeners as well. So thank you guys for tuning in. You know, it's been another episode of the TJMTM Jola Mista Madi podcast. It's been a history lesson and a half, and looking forward to talking to you guys on the next episode. Peace.